This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. We are once again with our expert all things naval, Dr. John Kuhn.
Hello.
And today we're going to talk about a lesser known naval theorist, although we can interrogate whether that phrasing is correct, a man named J.C. Wiley. So before we dive into Wiley, Dr. Kuhn, probably the two naval theorists that people know the best are Mahan and Corbett. So can you give us just a very brief summary of the ideas of Mahan and of Corbett?
Yeah, they're contemporaries of each other, and both of them were advocates for sea power. Mahan's conception of sea power was primarily economic, and so he had a conception that sea power involved trade and not just navies, and he found that sea power's most efficacious use in war was to conduct economic warfare, mm-hmm. that you basically would blockade or commerce raid your enemy into bankruptcy. So that was his major idea. And along with it went sort of a maritime geopolitical strategy that highlighted the importance of global trade and commerce to the wealth of nations. So that's Mahan in a nutshell. Corbett had the similar ideas. He was good friends with a lot of guys at the London School of Economics. But Corbett was more focused on using navies in war, mm-hmm. to support political objectives. So he was very Clausewitzian. He said you should always start with what your political objectives in war were going to be. And then the next thing you figured out is, well, what those political objectives were, how the Navy was going to help in an overall strategy, or grand strategy for that matter, although grand strategy is more for peacetime than it is for wartime, to achieve those political objectives. So he was sort of the father of what we would today call sea control, controlling the seas for your use, denying the seas for the enemy's use in order to achieve the objectives of the war. If the objective of the war is to have your army seize some province, then the Navy's role would depend on how maritime that theater of operations was going to be. Navies, you know, are only useful if they can support armies via projecting power or interfering with the enemy's projection of power via the sea. So Corbett was more operationally what Corbett would call minor strategy focused. Mahan was more major strategy focused, more grand strategy focused. But they were very complementary. But if you want to learn what to do with the Navy, at least in the early 20th century, Corbett's the theorist you want to read. If you want to learn what to do with all the elements of national power related to maritime commerce and wealth in wartime, then you go to Mahan.
Okay, so who is J.C. Wiley? What's his background?
So J.C. Wiley is a guy who grew up in New York City. His father was from South Carolina, but had immigrated up to... migrated from the south up to the north, and he had sort of a middle class life. He was a graduate of the Naval Academy. He never graduated from high school. He took the exam for Annapolis early while he was still 17. And he got the highest possible grade you could take on the entrance exam for the Naval Academy and got a congressional appointment. And instead of waiting a year and graduating from high school, he just went right into the Naval Academy without getting a high school without graduating from high school.
So yeah, what time frame are we talking about?
He graduated from the Naval Academy, I think, just as World War I was ending. So he graduated from the Naval Academy in the late 1920s. Okay. No, actually, 1932.
Okay. 1932. So he is solidly an interwar.
He's an interwar officer, but an interwar junior officer. Mm-hmm. Almost every single captain or skipper of a ship that he served under made 4 stars. So Wiley quipped. He goes. You know, it seemed like every time I turned around, one of my old bosses was making admiral, and a lot of them made 4-star admiral, including Chester Nimitz, J.O. Richardson, Robert Kearney, all of whom made 4 stars. So Wiley was like, Navy's a pretty good place if you want to have a career, because the opportunities for advancement are unlimited in the Navy.
So he's a surface guy?
He's a surface Annapolis grad. So he's squarely in the middle of what you would think of as Navy culture. He is what Peter Karsten would call an Annapolite.
So we've talked about naval culture in the prior century, where you have these almost explorer James Kirk's types who are captains as well as diplomats and all of that. How has that changed as we move into the 20th century interwar period?
Well, that's a really good question, because Wiley will actually account for that in his little book on theory, which is called Military Strategy. So for Wiley, the Naval Officer Corps was an interesting place, because it had become a Naval Officer Corps that was sort of two-sided, two-faced. And now we look back on it, we go, well, that was a really good officer corps to have. It prized technical expertise, but at the same time, it prized what it called strategy or strategic thinking. And so Wiley was a product of that interwar Navy, where it's now everybody who studies it, who's a naval historian, has tended to find that these were the most well-rounded naval officers that the United States Navy produced. They were very well-rounded. Your question about culture was really good, because Wiley, his first assignment was to the flagship of the Asiatic Fleet in China at Qingdao, which was where the Asiatic Fleet tended to anchor in the summer months, was at Qingdao, China. So his first skipper was Chester Nimitz, commanding the heavy cruiser USS Augusta. And so Wiley's, I'm trying to remember who the admiral was. The admiral was a really famous admiral. Hey, anyway, I'll remember his name later. But Wiley he learned about foreign cultures. So Wiley, one of the things about Wiley that people who've written about him, there's no biography of Wiley, unfortunately, was that he was very sensitive to culture. He was on the flagship when it visited Tokyo at the death of the victor of the Battle of Tsushima Strait, Admiral Togo Heihachiro. And he was one of the Americans who was picked to go up on the Asiatic Fleet flagship and provide a funeral party for the burial ceremony for Japan's Nelson, who was Admiral Togo.
So the strategic thinking that we have for our naval officers that we prize.
Yeah.
And is this developed educationally, or is it picked up culturally, or is it some manner of the two?
Well,
how did the Navy develop this?
As you know, Bill, education and culture are closely related. And in the interwar Navy, education was prized. Admiral King went to the Naval War College not one time, not two times, but 3 times as a student, as well as being an instructor there. Admiral Spruance was an instructor there. If you were the president of the Naval War College, you were considered to be on the fast track to high command, unlike today, where we sort of send admirals who aren't going anywhere to the Naval War College to be president of the Naval War College. They've tried to change that, and we may see that change with the current president of the Naval War College, who might actually get a 3rd star out of his job as the president of the Naval War College, but not because he was the president of the Naval War College. It's because he managed to leave there. So Wiley's a product of that culture, where studying strategy and operations and war planning were prized at the Naval War College. Mm-hmm. And he'll be associated with the Naval War College after the war. But it's what he did during the war that initially gained him most of his notoriety.
So tell us about that. What did he do during World War II?
Well, you know, in our course that we used to teach, we focused on history, theory, doctrine, practice. And Wiley's a fascinating example of sort of history, doctrine, theory, mm-hmm. and practice. Because he does all four, but he doesn't do them in that order.
Right.
He does them in the practice, doctrine, theory, history is the order that he actually used for what he comes up with military strategy. So he, when World War I breaks out, he is assigned, World War II breaks out, Wiley is assigned as an executive officer on a brand new destroyer that had been built by the Two Ocean Navy Act. And so he's doing anti-submarine warfare patrol in the Atlantic. An even newer destroyer comes out that has the most advanced naval surface search radar in the Navy on it, and it's the lead class of the Fletcher destroyer class, the USS Fletcher. The destroyer Fletcher class becomes justly famous in World War II. It's probably the best destroyer built during the war, just an amazing destroyer. Well, he deploys on the lead ship of this class as the executive officer, and he arrives at Noumea in New Caledonia, reports as the executive officer of the Fletcher, and then immediately on November the 11th goes up the Guadalcanal. Well, if you don't know anything about the history of World War II, November 11th is sort of the climax of the campaign of Guadalcanal, when the Japanese Navy, the Japanese Air Force, and the Japanese Army, and the American Navy, Marine Corps, Army Air Force are battling to control this little airfield on an island called Guadalcanal. He is involved in the surface battles there, and on board the Fletcher, he will be engaged in two of the fiercest naval battles. The Naval Battle of Guadalcanal, which is a three-day crazy battle. Two admirals are killed. He's actually on the Fletcher. The Fletcher's one of the few ships that's only slightly damaged in the Naval Battle of Guadalcanal. But while he is on that ship, he sets up what becomes the first CIC. He sets up in a plot behind the bridge on the destroyer Fletcher. Now, every ship in the Navy at that time had something called a surface plot behind the bridge, where they maintained a surface plot of where the ship was going and also where enemies might be, a rudimentary surface plot. They did it on a map on a table. Wiley positioned himself behind there with the captain on the bridge. There was a porthole, and he would yell things to the captain through the porthole. The interesting thing about Fletcher's plot was that's where the surface search radar, PPR, or PPI, planned position indicator, which was an O-scope that had been fine-tuned to sort of provide a 360-degree surface picture from the radar. So he manned that radar plot himself, not an enlisted guy. On one ear, he had orders to the gunnery officer, and on the other ear, he had orders to the torpedo officer, and then he would yell through the porthole at the captain. So totally multi-functioning, multi-compartmental. He basically was doing the kind of things we see fighter pilots do, you know, decades later, and multi-functioning and operating. And he ran that for the Fletcher. And then in the after-action report, he described in the after-action report, and this captain endorsed it, what he had done during these battles, these surface battles at Guadalcanal, the naval battle at Guadalcanal, and then another naval battle where he did really well and gave advance warning of the Japanese, but the admiral didn't listen to the Fletcher, and that was the Battle of Tassafaranga, which was the last major surface defeat for the U.S. Navy at Guadalcanal.
And you said this is the prototype CIC, and that is Combat Information
Center. Right. So after that, he goes to a destroyer minesweeper, kind of like the frickin' Kane. He's sent to the Kane, to this ship that's kind of like the Kane as the executive officer, and it's a mine-laying destroyer, but he's actually ferrying troops around during the Solomon's campaign. Finally, he's sent back to Pearl Harbor after being in the theater for over 6 months in combat. He's awarded a Silver Star for his actions at Guadalcanal. He gets back there, and instead of taking command of the ship, they go, oh, we want you to write the CIC doctrine for the surface Navy. And so he gets together with several members of Admiral Nimitz's staff, and in 1943 he produces the CIC Handbook for Destroyers, which becomes the standard surface doctrine for all surface ships in the U.S. Navy.
So he's clearly off to a good start in this war. And, of course, World War II is the war for the U.S. Navy
right.
in the Pacific. So how does he finish the war, and then what happens to him after the war?
So he has a stellar career. He ends up in command of the latest destroyers, and he'll come back to the United States, work some issues of setting up CICs and design for CICs. So he's with the design engineers. And this is where he becomes an ergonomic engineer. He's one of the first ergonomic engineers. And so they use him to say, okay, how will this work? So he gets with the engineers, and then they go, well, we're going to put this over here. He goes, no, get this over here. And so he helps with the design of the CICs for the new destroyers coming out and the training program. Then he goes back, commands a destroyer, and he finishes the war out providing picket radar destroyer duty against Japanese kamikaze aircraft.
So he sounds like a very proficient technician, tactician,
warrior. Yeah,
warrior.
So he's
very standard.
He's a tactical, technical warrior who's also the guy who's written all the doctrine. So he's probably one of the most prolific guys. He's if he were a battleship guy, he would be Willis Lee. He's a lot like, he and Willis Lee are a lot alike in terms of how they are.
And it sounds like he spent most of his career on the little stuff, the destroyers.
Right. He's a small boy. He's a destroyerman. All right. And the destroyerman after World War II will go on to great things. Stansfield Turner is a destroyerman. Elmo Zumwalt is a destroyerman. Jim Holloway, who later becomes an aviator in CNO, is a destroyerman. All these guys served on destroyers in World War II. So the destroyer cadre in World War II produces some of the most talented of the future leaders of the Navy for the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. So he started out the war as a lieutenant?
And
he ends the war as?
As a captain.
For Army audiences,
06. After the war, well, Dr. Abel's got a question, so go ahead.
No,
go ahead,
that's where Abel. I was headed. As you say, these destroyer guys are doing things after the war. So we're headed to the early Cold War. You know, Korea's going to happen, and that involves the Navy as well. So what's the rest of his career look like?
So the rest of his career is fascinating because he goes to the Naval War College. When he goes to the Naval War College, it's during the unification debates for unifying the military services. And he is opposed to that, just like Arleigh Burke is, just like Zumwalt is, just like just about most of the Navy guys were opposed to unification. So, but he's very sensitive to the culture of the time. So this sort of gives him his feeling for, okay, Navy guys have to give a crap about the other services. They have to understand land warfare. They can't just stay in their little bubble, because he sees the Navy get its ass handed to it by the other services in this battle because of its cultural misunderstanding and the fact that naval officers tend to think too narrowly about tactics and not enough about strategy. So he already sees a need that the Navy is sort of getting away from these forward-thinking strategic officers, and it's sort of losing ground. He also sees that there's developments in warfare that have sort of changed sort of how you have to think about warfare, and I'll talk about those when I talk about his theory. Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that. So he ends up at the Naval War College, and he's asked to form a studies group. Now, initially, the idea is that they'll form a strategy curriculum for the Naval War College. And this is called the Strategic Studies Group. It's the first strategic studies group that the Navy has. And in this, he begins an association with an expatriate German-Jewish academician, a guy named Herbert Rosinski. Herbert Rosinski is a fascinating guy. He had worked at the German Naval Staff College. He was a Clausewitz scholar. His understanding of Clausewitz was superb. And but Rozinski never wrote any books. He wrote essays on Mahan and Corbett and Clausewitz.
So he's a little bit of a John Boyd type.
Right. And Rozinski, but Rozinski's a professor.
Right.
He's a German academic. He initially ends up in England, but he makes his way to the Naval War College, where he joins the faculty of the Naval War College. And he takes Wiley on as his protege. And so Rozinski mentors Wiley at the Naval War College. And he wants to write a theory book about something called directed versus cumulative strategy. Now, Rozinski had gotten this idea from one of his intellectual heroes, a guy named Hans Delbruck. And so Wiley not only is well-versed in Clausewitz, but he's very, very well-versed in Hans Delbruck. But he never puts it all together, but he discusses these ideas with the now Admiral Wiley, Admiral J.C. Wiley. And so Wiley puts together a version of these ideas filtered through his own ideas. Now, Wiley's concern about military theory was it was not accessible to the common man.
Right.
The man, he says, the man in the street with the gun is who he calls that guy.
Yeah.
He says theory should be useful for the guy in the street with the gun.
It's a great phrase.
Yeah. And so he takes sort of Rozinski's, you know, and again, English isn't Rozinski's first language. It's like one of his, like his fifth language. And so he takes Rozinski's ideas and he translates those into something he calls a theory of power control, or a general theory of power control. And he produces the book Military Strategy, A General Theory of Power Control, but very much influenced by the ideas of Herbert Rozinski. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a maritime theory. This is a general theory of warfare. And essentially what Wiley says is that operational warfare can be lumped into two categories: cumulative operations and sequential operations. And Wiley has experience in both. Cumulative operations are like the operations he did in the North Atlantic against German submarines, or that U.S. submarines used in the Pacific against Japanese merchant ships. No single action is decisive. It's the cumulative effect of a diverse, diffuse series of actions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cumulative strategy. And Mahanian economic warfare comes under that. It's cumulative. On the other hand, Geminian warfare is sequential. And this is where he got the experience in the Solomons. You have to capture the airfield at Guadalcanal, establish air and sea control, and then sequentially, you go to the next island up the chain, New Georgia, capture the airfield at Munda Point, and then create air and sea control. And he takes this idea and says, well, this can be applied to all forms of warfare. Cumulative and sequential type mm-hmm. strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of his big contribution. It's very Delbruckian, all right?
I was going to say, I see echoes of Delbruck
has to do with fluid dynamics for cumulative operations and sort of Newtonian physics for sequential operations.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sort of, that's, and it's a really small little book. It's not very long at all. The entire theory only covers,
I think it's one chapter, right?
Right. It's, it is essentially 95 pages long.
Yeah.
So it's a treatise more than it is, but it's sort of a handbook. Theory handbook.
Is it just simply warfare as these two types, or is he going to more prescriptive?
So he says the purpose of warfare is to provide a measure of control to achieve a political objective. So that's why he calls it a theory of power control. And so what you have in warfare are competing power dynamics and differentials. So again, that's sort of that very Navy engineering sort of approach to warfare, which is, well, we've got a power mismatch here. How can we use that power mismatch to control something? All right? So we have more destroyers with radars than the Japanese do. so we can gain a better level of control over the air than the Japanese can gain over our level of control on the surface, which they're trying to attack with their aircraft. So, and he's almost the inventor of what we would call modern maritime air defense. There's also, he says, warfare has to account for six new things. Now remember, this is a guy coming out of World War II, all right? So you're going to go, duh, when I say these six things. But he's very, very deliberate about it. He says warfare has got to account for six developments in warfare. And those six developments are, one, mechanization. War has got to account for mechanization. You can't not account for mechanization in warfare. The Industrial Revolution means that we have to all learn about machines and how machines are to be used in warfare. Machines are part of warfare, so get over it. He says the other thing we have to deal with is explosives. Now, he's talking here about conventional explosives, but he's saying high explosives have changed warfare. So we have to account for that, and he's got a nice little discussion on that. You know, here's a nice little thing that he says. Modern methods encourage the use of explosives as a general agent of destruction. All right?
Don't say.
Think about Gaza. All right? Okay. Then he says we have to account for arms and revolution. In other words, revolution is the spirit of the age. And so when there are revolutions, it's no longer a revolution with halberds and swords. It's revolutions with machine guns and bombs and even airplanes. Mm-hmm. All right? We've seen revolutions with airplanes where the coup against Erdogan was a coup by the Air Force. Okay, so now the revolutionaries aren't just mobs in the street with rudimentary weapons. They have high-tech weapons.
Hang gliders.
Unmanned systems.
Yep.
Logistics in war. War is so big now that logistics cannot be hand-waved. Of course, this has been known for a long time. But he looks at logistics in warfare as a constraining factor. He says that logistics of warfare now constrains what you can do in warfare.
Mm-hmm. I think Napoleon would agree.
He addresses air theory here. With respect to air strategy, and here I'm going to merge logistics with the next major topic, flight, the logistic effect of the Industrial Revolution takes a different summed-up term. Logistic problems introduced by the Industrial Revolution are the basis of prevailing air power theory. So what he's basically saying here is air power is heavily logistics dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, air forces suffer more from logistical constraints than armies do.
Mm-hmm. An army without gas can walk someplace. An airplane without gas
can't. And an air force without bombs is just a reconnaissance force.
And you can see the influence of his time in the Pacific out there, where everything has to come by boat out to some remote island.
And that leads us to aviation. He says, get used to it. The air domain is here. You have to learn how to operate in an environment where aircraft are ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the final piece is nuclear energy in war. And here he's worried that people are going to treat nuclear weapons like just another weapon. He says that's a mistake. All right, so here he is. Now I don't know. Some of this was written almost 15 to 20 years after he initially broached these ideas. So he may have had the benefit of the work of Hans Morgenthau in order to say what he has to say about nuclear weapons, and that they should be treated not as just another weapon, that they're a new thing in their own right, and you really have to deal with them, and that they're strategic weapons, they are not tactical weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually where I was going to ask, is because in the post-World War II era, nuclear weapons are the new cool toy out there. So he views them kind of not as just another toy, but as something specific to be addressed. So the question is in what cases does he think that these nuclear weapons should be used? Are they just strategic weapons, like strategic bombing? Are they inherently political weapons?
So this was not in his original theory. He adds this in his postscript.
Yes.
All right. He's got two postscripts. One of them is on these six factors. The other one is on maritime strategy. But basically what he says is that the pattern of strategy today means that these weapons, because you have problems predicting enemy behavior, these weapons are more about control. So nuclear weapons should be used to control the behavior of your enemy.
Deterrence.
Bingo. And again, he's writing in a period where you've got Bernard Brody, you've got Kahn, you've got Schelling, you've got all these deterrent theorists. So it's not like he's saying anything new. He's just saying, he just sort of summarizes it. His section is extremely small. Again, it's a really, really easy book to read. He wrote it that way so it would be accessible.
Right.
So people would read it. He kept it short because he figured if he kept it short, people would read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you've said a word that I think is key to understanding Wiley several times already. When he says control, what does he mean?
By control, he means you have a means to leverage your opponent and your opponent's decision-making. But a theory can provide a stable and orderly point of departure from which we might proceed to specific facts at hand in carrying out. So it should be for the purpose of controlling, of gaining a measure of control, all right? If you don't have control and you're under the enemy's control, you need to subvert his control. So essentially, by control, he means either they're getting you to do something because of a power imbalance in the relationship, or you're getting them to do something because of a power imbalance in the relationship. The example here is the Bay of Pigs,
mm-hmm.
right? We're gonna do a blockade. They call it a quarantine, but it's a blockade. You know, it's a specific blockade, but it's a blockade. And because we have greater power at sea than you do, you have to change the terms of the debate and employ forms of control that you don't want to employ.
Is this an outgrowth of Corbett's idea?
Yes. So the ideas about sea control and control of the sea, he takes those to the next level for strategy.
This sounds a lot like a concept in chess called Zugzwang, where you basically try to put your opponent into a situation where they're forced to make a move against their best interest.
Right. But in doing that, you gain a measure of control over them
right.
and their behavior. Because in order to avoid that move, they're going to do something that you'd rather have them do, right? Normally. One wonders if he had ever played the game of Go, right? Because it's almost Chinese, the way he thinks about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
you can approach it from the two different perspectives of cumulative over a series of small little cuts and nips all over the place, or alternatively, one to the next, to the next, to the next.
Right. I mean, this is a guy who is patrolling off the coast of Japan in 1945 with a destroyer providing air defense for aircraft carriers as they project power ashore against the Japanese. And in a couple cases, as carriers are actually providing fighter escorts for B-29s.
Mm-hmm.
So you are forcing the enemy to dance to your tune, right? He has no control at sea. You have absolute control at sea. Now his options are very, very limited.
But he can still
defend himself against invasion. You haven't taken that option away from him, but you've taken all his other options away from him.
And so I can see how the Pacific War influenced that, because you had the sequential means of control, which is up through the Solomons and New Guinea, through the Carolines, all that Central Pacific campaign. But you also had the cumulative effect of the submarine
campaign. And the war ends with a cumulative strategy in place, where you're just making it more and more and more miserable and difficult for the Japanese to operate. Mm-hmm. You're giving them fewer and fewer and fewer options until they finally say, okay, we're going to pick the least bad option.
Yeah.
All right?
So one of the things these theorists often do is pigeonhole themselves into a service, a branch, a particular part of strategy. So often it's the branch they're from, right? So we talk about naval strategists as naval strategists. They deal with navies.
Right.
As Wiley self-reports, and as you say, he is not writing naval strategy. He's writing military strategy.
Right. This is a general military strategy.
So
that's why he names it military strategy. It's not strategy for armies. It's strategy for military in its broadest sense.
So it makes sense how you might envision a Wiley-esque application, whether cumulative or sequential, within a, say, a land campaign or
right.
a sea campaign. How does he relate this to kind of the joint enterprise? How might these campaigns work across branches in a Wiley construct?
Well, you know, he was concerned about how all the pieces of the national military establishment fit together. Mm-hmm. Like most naval officers at the time, he wasn't very happy with the role that had been assigned to the Navy. Mm-hmm. But in terms of applying, he's very popular with Air Force guys.
Right.
Right? So within a joint application, the idea is the Wiley application, I think you see its joint application reflected most in something like an air tasking order by the Air Force. And that's a joint document mm-hmm. because you're servicing land targets, in some cases maybe sea targets, although the Navy still sort of says, no, those are ours. But you know, today's Navy can't really say that anymore because we've got such limited assets. So Wiley lends himself to that construct,
mm-hmm.
I think he's been influential that way. I've met a lot of Air Force guys that are very familiar with Wiley. I've met a lot of Air Force guys that think Wiley, you know, Wiley sort of prefigures some of the things that you'll find in Frank Hebert's work. You know, he who can destroy a thing can control a thing, right?
So why is this naval officer who started off writing because he was concerned about the role of the Navy in this post-World War II environment, basically write a book for basically joint doctrine or all that kind of stuff? In other words, how come he didn't
go back to the six things, right?
Yeah.
All six of those things are not unique to the Navy, all right? None of those are unique to the Navy. Air power, nuclear weapons, mechanization, logistics, high explosives, coin, all of it, none of it, you know, and some of it is like almost, although, you know, coin and revolutions, you know, navies have been part of revolutions since the beginning of time, you know, I mean, the Russian Navy revolted twice, and the German Navy revolted. So that brings up the issue of his influence. Why, you know, what was his influence?
Well, it strikes me as, like, because you've got the Billy Mitchells of the world. You even have the Mahans or the Corbetts that are looking at the world, some more than others.
Well, he's thinking got that stuff.
Yeah.
You need something that's going to appeal to a broader audience. So this military strategy, again, the basic precepts of this were come up with through a study group that he did at the Naval War College under the auspices of Herbert Rozinski in the early 50s. So he wants something that will appeal to a very broad audience inside the Department of Defense.
And not just a parochial one like many other theorists are aiming for.
Right. He wants a theory that will appeal to a broad audience. Mm-hmm. It's something of an evolution of Corbett. Because Corbett appeals to a broader audience than much of Mahan's work, although I would say, you know, a lot of people misunderstand what Mahan was actually trying to get across, you know, including Mahan himself initially, because he was forced to rush that first book into print, and it wasn't what he wanted it to be.
And of course, that's when we all remember.
Yeah, and that's what we all remember. You know, we don't remember the second book, which was actually a far more coherent and useful book. So this is something of an evolution. Now, what was his influence? Again, I think because of the time in which this was produced, the 50s and the 60s, it sort of becomes this sort of cult book, right? That it's like On War. You know, the only people that are really aware of this are, you know, people in the Kriegsakademie and in the German military establishment, right? On War. So for military strategy, the only people that are really have a lot of awareness of this are people who go through the Naval War College or people who are in the Navy.
So he's not a nuclear theorist and fits in that pigeonhole.
He's not a naval theorist.
He's not an air power theorist. So all these guys are coming up with all these different great ideas for their one specific niche, and he's across all of them.
Right. But where does he have the most impact in the real world as a theorist? In maritime strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are the only people that are really quite aware of his work and find it useful. So the authors of the U.S. maritime strategy in the 1980s, and they say we're going to use the Navy, are very familiar with what?
Mm-hmm.
Peter Schwartz, Robbie Harris, and I'm trying to remember the third guy's name. It's Paul Giara. I forget, but there's like three guys, you know, and plus some other guys that are uniformed naval officers. And so, but Peter Schwartz specifically says, I had J.C. Wiley in mind when I was helping to write the maritime strategy for the Navy in the 1980s. And that becomes a strategy. And the maritime strategy is more of a cumulative strategy than it is a sequential strategy. The whole idea is we control the seas, we're going to project power and force the Soviets to honor the threats against their maritime flanks and dilute their military power. So we'll have less of that military power to deal with in the main theater of operations in Europe. And so that's where he has his most important impact in sort of the history of warfare. That's where the theory has an impact. But the theory is more than just a theory for Navy guys to come up with a strategy for the late Cold War. It's a very useful book to help frame your strategic thinking. And like all theorists, he says you have to fit the theory to the particular circumstances of the age. So it's not a theory that's set in stone. It's a theory to help you think about the problems that you're trying to solve in your age.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how you might apply Wiley in a series of scenarios, from fairly obvious to maybe fairly arcane. Let's start with an obvious one. Let's say near future, China invades Taiwan. Okay. The United States military establishment is holding a copy of Wiley's military strategy. How do you apply Wiley to that problem, that China has invaded Taiwan?
Well, the first thing you have to do is actually read Wiley and understand it, mm-hmm. which most of the people developing strategy inside the Navy, I would say, haven't done. Okay, but let's just assume they go to the Naval War College. They're introduced to J.C. Wiley. Perhaps not. You know, the way you would deal with that is the first thing you look at is we want the Chinese to decide they're going to lose if they invade Taiwan. So what we need to do is create a strategy for deterrence. There's two approaches to that. One, we are going to wipe the seas clean of you in the first week of battle. That's really a sequential strategy, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And for years and years in the Pacific Fleet, that was the doctrine. They called it the fight tonight. We're going to win that first fight. And when we do that, that'll convince the Chinese that this is a non-starter. Okay. The other approach is to say, no, what we need to do is employ a strategy of deterrence. That would be more of a cumulative strategy. building alliances, creating networks, supporting Taiwan defending itself, creating a system for sustained application of military force to oppose Chinese power projection from the mainland. All right. There was an attempt to do that, and that was air-sea battle. That was really a wily approach to the problem. All right. The Army took great exception to it because they didn't see a role for themselves in it, because the idea was that we'll use a cumulative strategy to convince the Chinese that not only will we defend Taiwan and sink Chinese ships and shoot down Chinese airplanes and missiles, but we'll strike targets in China itself. Mm-hmm. All right? That is no longer the strategy. All right? Mm-hmm. It was designed in the Office of Net Assessments and in DARPA by guys like Andrew Kropenevich, and it was found wanting because it overestimated our ability to convince the Chinese to sort of back off. It was figured all it would do was piss the Chinese off and cause them to retrench in terms of, and it might actually make things worse. But so that's how you take Wiley to Taiwan, all mm-hmm. right? So it's a spectrum of conflict. So you try to convince Chinese decision makers before the first shot that it's going to be an attrition war that's going to be too expensive for them to win.
Does Wiley make any comments about how to make value judgments? As for instance, like Clausewitz spends a little bit of time talking about the concept of relative value and to how much each opponent values the outcome. Does Wiley spend any time with that?
So he sort of gets at that when he talks about the limitations of existing theories. All right. This is mostly informed by the Korean War. All right. Mm-hmm. He's particularly interested in Liddell Hart's concept of the indirect approach. But he says it's limited. He basically says Liddell Hart's approach is enough to make Clausewitz turn over in his grave.
Mm-hmm.
So he does. So he's, you know, he uses sort of Clausewitz. He basically, his criticism of Clausewitz is Clausewitz didn't talk about the maritime domain. Other than that, Clausewitz is great. And you should use Clausewitz. So he actually leverages pre-existing theories to make value judgments about things.
So he's not viewing his theory is not a replacement for that which has come before.
No.
His is meant to sit on top.
His is meant to account for the issue of power dynamics and control in what we today, he doesn't use this term, would call multi-domain warfare. Yeah.
So let's make this a slightly more complicated scenario. You talked about the role of a kind of a Wiley approach in deterrence. What about if in a situation where the war has already started? So like the Russo-Ukraine war. If you're Ukraine, you're facing a large-scale invasion, they're already on your territory. How might you apply Wiley's strategy in that situation?
Well, it is being applied, maybe not deliberately, but the war has gone to, it's a contest of wills now, mm-hmm. which is right in Wiley's wheelhouse.
This is cumulative.
It's a contest between essentially the will of one man, Putin, mm-hmm. against the will of the nation he's fighting, Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Zelensky, all mm-hmm. right? It's not Zelensky's will against Putin's will. And again, it's also against other wills. So right now the war is a cumulative war
mm-hmm.
on both sides. Both sides, there are sequential aspects of it, but the sequential phase of the war was basically over when the Russian offensive failed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a war of attrition and exhaustion, and those wars are almost always follow what Wiley would call cumulative strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's come down to an approach of who is going to crack first. Whose system is going to crack first? It's essentially the Cold War with fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so Wiley would argue that it's going to, the ingredients are going to be economic and strategic willpower. Mm-hmm. Whoever can maintain the economic impetus to continue to resist or attack, in the case of the Russians, will eventually gain the upper hand in power control. Now, that doesn't mean you might get to a point where people are ready to negotiate. You might get to a point where you get the miracle of the House of Kiev and Putin dies, right? Right. And his predecessor says, hey, let's talk Turkey. His successor says, hey, let's talk Turkey
here. Right.
You know, let's talk about, you know, let's have negotiations, all mm-hmm. right? Or on the obverse, Zelensky dies and you do get a different political dynamic in Ukraine. I think there are a whole lot more people who are willing to see it to the bitter end in the Ukraine than there are in Russia. The problem is, you know, one of these is an autocracy, it's an authoritarian state, and the Strategic Bombing Survey found that authoritarian states are really, really good at sort of maintaining policies that piss everybody off mm-hmm. by repressing people expressing their discontent, mm-hmm. all right? So the Wiley approach to this war is, okay, how do we maintain will, and how do we do that? That's why it's the war, once we have the presidential election in the United States, that's going to be a big factor here. Mm-hmm. It could be a huge setback for the Ukrainians. That's why the Ukrainians are probably already thinking about this in sort of Wileyan terms of how do we maintain the willpower and the resources to continue to resist the Russians.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm picking up from what you're saying is that Wiley is less of a prescriptive theory and much more of a descriptive theory.
Right. He helps you think about what you're trying to do in the war. Okay. Now, what's the political objective? All right. I mean, the Russians have an absolutist political objective. They want regime change in Kiev. Mm-hmm. That is Putin's war aim. Mm-hmm. The Ukrainian war aims are pretty clear too. Get back all the territory, status quo, antebellum 2014. Mm-hmm. Okay, now they might be able to negotiate that, but so far the Russians have indicated no willingness to even talk about mm-hmm. that. They actually want to retain everything that they've captured, status quo,
plus
2022, right?
Right.
So they want to So the war aims are actually pretty clear. And Wiley says that's one of, you know, when you can get that, that's actually helps you think about things more clearly. It's so much less, because he talks about counterinsurgency and revolutionary warfare. And he says that's so much more messy, mm-hmm. right, than this. And, you know, at least the war aims are clear. Once you figure out what the enemy wants, then you can figure out how you want to gain a measure of control over him to deny him what he wants. In both cases, these are strategies of denial. Mm-hmm. Okay, Putin is denying Ukraine getting its land back. Zelensky is denying Putin regime change, or the Ukrainians are denying Putin regime change in Kiev. All right.
So let's take a stab at maybe one that might be fun. Right now, when we think of space, we think of space power as basically being satellites.
Right.
It's things orbiting the Earth. In the future, we will move space power away from the Earth to asteroids, to the moon, to other planets. So as we do that, how might Wiley's theories apply to a brand new domain away from the Earth in space?
Well, again, it's a matter of control. Who's controlling the satellites? Who is using the information from space systems for economic benefits, for scientific benefits, for national prestige? A lot of what we see in terms of security strategies in space right now have to do with prestige.
Right.
You know, the Indians, the Japanese, the Chinese, the French, the Americans, the Europeans, the non, you know, those Frank Hebert non-state players in the space game today. And so this idea of prestige, and you know, and so you have to think about the relationship of prestige to power. And this is where Wiley's attitude is saying, well, you got to understand, how are you going to understand the other guy if you don't understand where he's coming from culturally? So if you don't try to understand, you got to understand his cultural ethos for doing what he's doing. And then you might be able to gain some measure of control over him. You know, you go back to the Indian Mutiny, right? One way to gain control is to threaten to annihilate the souls of your opponents. So the British do that by tying prisoners to the muzzles of cannons and blowing them apart and completely destroying their bodies. Now they can't be reincarnated. That's a control method. That's Wiley. Mm-hmm. That's how we're going to win. We're just going to convince them, you're not only going to lose in this life, but you're going to lose in the next life.
Okay? The old comment of how do you make the other guy quit?
How do you make the other guy quit? Or how do you make the other guy do something you want him to do?
So let's take an example from a theorist we referenced earlier. If we're doing kind of a Jomini Mahan space theory, that might make sense to take a piece of key terrain like the moon.
Right.
Would Wiley agree with that? To seize the moon and hold it as an asset in an important transit lane?
Only if it gives you some measure of control over an adversary. That's what Wiley would say to that.
So it's more about for...
Now, you might want to... And if the moon... Again, if the moon has economic value,
right,
then yes, because Wiley's very broad. He includes economics as a way to leverage, mm-hmm. all right? So gaining control of resources is a way to gain power, and it's a way to gain control. If you can control the access to, go back to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. If you can control 50% of the semiconductor production in the world, then that will give you a huge measure of control, mm-hmm. which is why the Chinese want Taiwan. Taiwan produces 50% of the semiconductors on the global market.
Mm-hmm. So, to your Frank Herbert references that you keep making, the author of Dune, of course, is it fair to say that Wiley not just discusses kind of kinetic and physical strategy, but he also talks about psychological and kind of strategy within the mind.
Yeah, the word I would use is cognitive. He's very like Clausewitz this way. The idea is to get inside the other guy's head using power dynamics mm-hmm. to make him or her or it do what you want. Mm-hmm. Okay, be it a mistake. Commit to a false theater of operations so you can be in the main theater of operations. It's, you know, we could even use Napoleon, right? I'm going to put my best marshal in Italy where I won my major, where I ended the last war twice mm-hmm. with, you know, my major enemy, Austria. Okay, so misdirect him. So he's very psychological. And again, I don't know if Wiley ever met John Boyd, but I think that would have been an interesting discussion between those two guys.
Oh, yeah. So who's using Wiley right now?
So Wiley is being used at the Naval War College to some degree. We have an optional reading here in our own curriculum for him. I'm not sure how much he's being used over at SAMS, but there's a guy named Nick Prime, Dr. Nick Prime over at SAMS, and he's sort of the guy... in PME right now, who's a specialist in Wiley. So it might be worth getting Nick over here and kind of doing a follow-on discussion with Nick. Mm-hmm. And then he'll go, yeah, well, everything John Kuhn told you was wrong, and here's what I think, you know, about Wiley. So Wiley is present in PME, but I'm not convinced that he's got as wide a diffusion as perhaps he should have. There, for a while, I thought it was going to happen via the strategy bridge. The strategy bridge used to be sort of run by a bunch of Wiley acolytes. Mm-hmm. And you don't see much. Of course, the strategy bridge is no longer publishing anymore.
Right.
So that's part of the problem is there's no platform out there other than guys like John Kuhn who are sort of pushing Wiley, you know, or Nick Prime or whoever is the Wiley person. There is a J.C. Wiley professor at the Naval War College.
Yeah, very nice. Dr. Keenan, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.